Good morning, I'm Chris Berube, sitting in today as your host of Focus. Last night was the season 6 premiere of Mad Men, a show that is equal parts soapy and heavy. Set in the 60s in New York, the television drama follows the lives of ad executives at Sterling Cooper Draper Price, an ad agency on Madison Avenue. Some have criticized the show for being a bit smug, for taking a look at the past and saying, hey, we do better than that now. Others say it's one of the best shows on TV. This hour on Focus, I'll be speaking with three professors from the University of Illinois who've edited a brand new book, Mad Men, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s. Do you love Mad Men? Or could you not get into it at all? What did you think of the season 6 premiere? Let us know what you think coming up on Focus right after the news. I'm Chris Berube, and this is Focus. The AMC show Mad Men had its 6th season premiere last night, reintroducing us to the world of the 1960s New York ad agency Sterling Cooper Draper Price. When audiences were first introduced to Don Draper in 2007, he was an ad man with aspirations towards the philosophical. Here he is pitching a Kodak camera product at the end of the show's 1st season.
There's the rare occasion when the public can be engaged on a level beyond flash. If they have a sentimental bond with the product, nostalgia. It's delicate, but potent. It's a twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine.
Well, over the years, we've learned a lot about Don. His character and the others on the show are a lens through which the show has examined period sexism and issues of class and consumer culture. For a lot of people, Mad Men is soapy and stylish and fun, but the period setting means that there's always a lot more to talk about. There's a new book that looks at many of the social and political issues in the show called Mad Men, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style in the 1960s. The editors of the book are three professors at the University of Illinois, and they're here with us today. Lauren Goodlad is an associate professor of English and director of the Unit for Criticism and Interpretive Theory at the U of I. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lilia Kaganovsky is an associate professor and of Slavic and Comparative Literature and Media and Cinema Studies here. Good morning. Thanks
good
for
morning.
Joining us.
Thank you.
And Robert Rushing is an associate professor of Italian and Comparative Literature at the U of I. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you for being here. Now, before we start the show, we're just going to say for listeners that we are going to discuss some specific plot points of Mad Men, possibly including last night's season premiere. So if you've never seen the show, be forewarned. I don't think we can really ruin this show. It's so much in the culture at this point, but we will be talking about some specific points. And if you'd like to call in with your comments about the show or about any of the topics we're talking about, our number here is 217-333-9455. So let's start. The three of you come from very different backgrounds in terms of what you study. How did you get involved with Mad Men as a subject? And we'll start with you, Professor Kaganovsky.
Sure. I think that for me, the first thing is because I do a lot of work with cinema, 50s and 60s films and the stylishness of 50s and 60s films, which I think the show definitely capitalized on. It is a television show, but it owes so much to the cinema of the time. And so style, I would say, was the first thing that I went for.
Well, I am a Victorianist, and most Victorian novels were published serially. So I had never intended to write on serial television. And originally, I was watching the show on DVD, not watching it as it aired, and therefore not getting the full effect of following it as a serial narrative. But because I also work on masculinity issues, it eventually became clear to me that this show was doing fascinating things with reinventing the serial format. So that really pulled me in.
Well, I think one of the first things that brought me in was I have a great love for the 1960s Italian director Michelangelo Antonioni. And there's a clear influence on Mad Men from those films as well. I think, like Professor Kaganovsky, I was really drawn in by questions of style and seeing a form of the 1960s that we had not traditionally seen in the United States. Normally, when we think of the 1960s, we think of hippies with fringe jackets and peace signs and flowers and whatnot. And this was a very buttoned-down, very trim, ultra-stylish, kind of minimalist, and very mid-century modern look at the 1960s. If you watch European films, you see a lot of that. But in the U.S., we had not seen much of that up until Mad Men.
Well, let's actually talk about the period setting of the show and how the show kind of creates a 60s in a way that, as you say, is not something we've really seen in America before. What's kind of the period of the 60s that Mad Men has created in the imaginations of our culture? And Professor Rushing, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really the early 1960s. This was a period that was kind of missing from the collective imagination in the United States. Again, we go back to Haight-Ashbury. We think of the mega concerts of the 1960s and less of the kind of long. Well, I think in the case of Mad Men, it would be appropriate to call it a long hangover of the 1950s, the kind of conformist button-down gray flannel suits. And to show American audiences in particular this new version of an epic that they thought they knew, I think that's the first contribution that really caught my eye and made me think the show's doing something really worthwhile.
Yeah, and I think that what's so important about that is that we are living after the 60s counterculture. And so it's very important for us who think of ourselves as so post-counterculture to be looking at this pre-counterculture figure who both puts us in touch with America's past and says something so resonant for our own day. We kind of know that even though Don is coming from this past that's been created for us with such painstaking detail, that what he's saying and what he's experiencing is very much about what we're experiencing today. And when you start to look back at the period texts that Mad Men is interested in invoking all the time, like the man in the gray flannel suit, what you realize is that Don could not be more unlike Thomas Rath. He may look like him. Several times characters liken him to Gregory Peck in that role and in other roles. The style is there, but the affect of a businessman in the early 60s is saying something about what we're thinking about today.
Yeah, in a way, that affect really is an affect of someone clinging on to power in a lot of ways. And I think kind of one of the common scolds of the show from people who aren't fans of it is that it is kind of, it's a little bit smug in its relationship with the early 60s, that it kind of looks back on it in a way and says, silly 1960s, we know better than you today. What do you, Lilia, what do you make of that particular criticism of the show?
Well, I think we spend a lot of time in the introduction to our volume trying to undo that particular criticism or trying to answer that particular criticism. The thing about the show is that it, at least in our opinion, is that it tries to give us the truth of the 60s in a kind of stylized, obviously, way. And the problem with looking back on it is that you think that that it's doing it in order to make us feel better. But actually, I think it's doing it to make us realize all of the things that we're doing still today that we don't know are bad for us, dangerous, et cetera.
Yeah, let's Lauren, you have an essay in the book that does actually deal with that specifically. It talks about how the show relates to neoliberalism specifically today. Can you talk a bit about that issue of how the show kind of reminds us of how capitalism has gone wrong in a way?
Well, that's a very big question. But I mean, my chapter in the book is actually about the Israeli tourist board coming to New York to get an advertising agency to help them sell Exodus. And that also resonates with the way in season 3, Don is involved in a campaign for Hilton Hotels. And he comes with a campaign that says, you know, how do you say towels in Farsi, Hilton? You know, so America's, we're talking about the peak of American power and prosperity. You know, and yet, as you say, we recognize that Don has to cling to power. In fact, he has to positively invent himself in order to have power. The women in the show, they have to invent themselves just to be able to get a foot in the door. So in that sense, even though we're talking about the peak of American prosperity and, you know, agencies like Sterling Cooper Draper and Sterling Cooper Draper Price later on are able to get clients presumably more easily than they would today with a bad economy, what we're seeing is somebody that has to invent himself constantly and characters who have to find a way to insert themselves constantly in a way that we have to do today in order to succeed.
Well, let's talk a bit about the season six premiere last night. Robert, if you could set the table, where are we now chronologically at the beginning of season six? Where are we in history?
Well, if we've understood correctly, we believe that we're looking at New Year's Eve of 1967 going into 1968. And we open this season in Hawaii. So we have a kind of exotic locale still within the United States, still within the American context. And so what we're looking at, historically speaking, is that the kind of more conformist button-down mid-century modern 1960s is pretty clearly about to be definitively behind us. It's been receding throughout the series, but it's about to be completely gone for the audience. And what's coming up, of course, are the really big crises, the student movements, the free speech movement, the European strikes of 1968. And those are just a few months away at the time of the season's opening.
It's funny. It occurred to me watching the show last night that all of a sudden I was thinking, has the whole point of Mad Men just been building towards the Vietnam War? Is the Vietnam War kind of the big conclusion, like the big clashing of symbols at the end? I don't know. What do you think about that?
I would say that Vietnam is the elephant in the room, the way that the counterculture has to be the elephant in the room. It's so interesting in the premiere, the way, you know, Don is paired with somebody who's in the midst of fighting Vietnam but wants to identify with him as a fellow soldier. And so it brings in the whole question of Don's fake identity in a way that, you know, works. It's not soapy, like you say. It's subtle because we viewers know, because we've been following the show, that, you know, this is Don at his weakest point. He knows that he's a fraud. But the guy from Vietnam doesn't know that he's a fraud, and Don ends up giving the bride away.
I wonder if, to some degree, also, I was just thinking about the book that Don is reading on the beach. You have is Dante's Inferno, and of course he's looking at the most famous passage about, you know, halfway through life. This, you know, I found myself on. Rob will do this better than I can. But I wonder if to some degree 67, 68 represents a kind of midlife crisis for the United States, that there is a way in which it comes out of the war as feeling very young and hip and on top of things. And this is precisely the moment where things begin to break down. So it's not, you know, I think we read that passage from the Inferno as a midlife crisis for Don, which he's been having for years, but it might also be a midlife crisis for the nation.
Actually, I'd like to play a clip from last night's season premiere, which this clip actually is what a lot of people have been talking about on social media. It's Roger Sterling, who is one of the partners at the ad agency, and he's in therapy, and he says something very revealing in a very Roger kind of way. So let's hear that clip.
What are the events in life? It's like you see a door. The first time you come to it, you say, oh, what's on the other side of the door? Then you open a few doors. Then you say, I think I want to go over that bridge this time. I'm tired of doors. Finally, you go through one of these things, and you come out the other side, and you realize that's all there are. Doors and windows and bridges and gates, and they all open the same way, and they all close behind you. Look, life is supposed to be a path, and you go along, and these things happen to you, and they're supposed to change you, change your direction. But it turns out that's not true. It turns out the experiences are nothing. They're just some pennies you pick up off the floor, stick in your pocket, and you're just going in a straight line to you know where.
That's the character Roger Sterling, played by John Slattery, in a clip from last night's season premiere of Mad Men Season 6. And that comment is, I mean, it is kind of an existential comment on his part, But it also, I think, says a lot about this idea of a midlife American crisis. Robert, would you like to comment on that?
Sure. There's too much to say about that clip, so I'm sure Lauren and Lilia will help me out and add some commentary to it as well. But I think the thing I pick out as Roger is speaking there is this persistence of doors and windows, and you just go through and it's the same thing over and over and over again, that he wants some kind of radical change in his life, and he's not getting it. But there are characters in the show, and one character in particular, namely Don Draper, who persistently, in fact, we see this quite literally at the beginning of every single episode of the show, who, when confronted by the windows of his oppressive office space, looks out into space and then watches those doors and windows dissolve around him. And it catapults him into a kind of free fall. And at the end of that free fall, he reconstitutes himself as a new person. And this is one of the really, truly grand themes of the show, is that Don Draper is persistently being tempted by the possibility of making himself anew. That's the citation from Dante at the beginning of this episode. Dante himself is saying, here I am lost in a dark forest. I've gone morally astray. This is the moment in which we knew that Don was probably cheating on Megan. And so I've gone morally astray. How can I make myself into a new person with a transformative experience? That's an existential trope that runs throughout the show, but it's also what advertising is supposed to do. And this is one of the reasons that Don is so good at it.
Yeah, this is something that comes up again and again in the show. And I mean, you see it in the introduction, which I know Matthew Weiner did not make, but where sort of this male figure is falling off a tower. He's falling and falling. And first we see it from his perspective. And then the next thing we see is sitting on a couch. Mm-hmm. So essentially it's the idea that he kind of fell off and then could rebuild himself. And I feel like that's a really American theme, right?
It's an American theme and a very modern theme, too. One of the things that we notice a lot is that people feel good when they feel that their life path is growth with redemption and having something that you didn't have 10 years ago. As Pete says in the finale for last season, I want to feel like all of this getting old is worth something. And what's really interesting is that for a while, Roger was kind of a laughingstock. Don was the really protean self-inventor. He always had nine lives. He could pull himself out of any hole. Roger was just, you know, on a path to self-destruction or just being a laughingstock figure, writing his memoir, Sterling's Gold, for example, getting involved with a secretary, marrying her, repeating himself over and over again. It looked as though that was going to be what he did while Don was inventive and imaginative. But now it turns out that Don is the man who is repeating himself and is in that decline. And Roger's actually doing really well with the later 60s. He's found a way to make himself in sync. He's in analysis. He's experimenting with drugs. He's kind of a man for the hour. Don is in a real crisis. He's in hell, literally. And figuratively, we know that something really serious is going to happen to him in this season.
For those who haven't watched the show, there's a plot line in the last season where Roger Sterling, who's kind of this, you know, very arch kind of conservative male, takes LSD, which at the time I thought was a ridiculous plot line, but I'm starting to realize it was kind of a stroke of genius a little bit. you're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. We're talking about season 6 of Mad Men and the new book, Mad Men, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s. If you have comments on Mad Men, do you love the show? Do you have issues with it? Give us a call, 217-333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And you can also contact us on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. So I want to talk a bit about the aesthetics of the show. And I feel like at the top we were talking about how each of you got into it, and the same way that I got into it, I think, which is that it has this glossy surface that's really appealing. And that's kind of the way into the show for a lot of people. Do you feel like that kind of hides a lot of sins about the show? Kind of the glossy, stylish surface? Lily, I'd love to go to you on this one.
Sure. You should probably go to Rob. But the surface is everything on this show. It does not hide, but in fact reveals everything. Is everything that you need to know is up front and on and visually constructed. And I think that that's one of its brilliances, is that We want the show to have depth, but again, like the opening sequence, even though it was not Winer's own, but nonetheless, there's a flatness to the show that I think is actually constitutes its meaning.
Yeah, I think that's very nicely put. I would just add that this idea that essentially depth can be in the surface of things, that the meaning of the show very often is on the exterior. We know that Don's identity is not really Don Draper. At a certain point, as he's forced into signing a contract with his advertising firm, and the fact that he's not really the person that he says he is revealed. Bert says, what does it matter who's signing this anyway, right? And we know that he goes by multiple names. Betty Draper has changed her name. Everybody in the show is ready to reinvent themselves. I think one of the things that makes Roger such an adorable character, actually, is that he's come to it as we would, the idea of total self-reinvention, a little bit more slowly and a little bit more reluctantly. But at the end, he's willing to reveal his surface, the sequence that you're thinking about actually from last season. It's a glorious moment. It's just only 3 or 4 seconds long, is Roger Sterling standing stark naked, as high as can be, on LSD in front of a Manhattan window. And he raises his arms up, and it's clearly a moment of immense personal triumph for him. And it's quite literally written there on the surface. We don't have to peer into the inside to see what's going on. It's all on the outside. It's actually all on his skin. And I think that's one of the really great things that the show can do.
Do you think that some people who get caught up in the style of the show, and the style really has influenced kind of a revival in interest in certain men's fashions, particularly kind of the, you know, thin ties, you know, well-cut suits. There's also been women's fashion to some extent, a similar revival. Do you think that interest can kind of obscure what's interesting about it to a lot of people?
No, actually, I think that the two things work together extraordinarily well, and that's what disturbs us. In other words, when we see something that looks that good, we want to be that. But these people are bad, and they're miserable. At least, you know, by this point, we know them so well that we identify with them and we forgive them for a lot of their sins. Nonetheless, it's really jarring to see something that looks so good and inside is so emptied out and corrupt. So it's the tension between those things that makes it so arresting. And it makes it too disturbing for some people to enjoy.
And I'd just add to that we have two essays actually in the volume that are specific, one about men's fashion and one about women's fashion. And it's not possible to talk about the surface of things, the style that people wear, without also talking about identity. Even people who intentionally dress as much like schlubs as they can, and there are plenty of them in the academic world, even people who do that are trying to signal something about who it is that they are, or more to the point, who it is that they would like to be. And I think the sort of aspirational nature of the show, which it puts on display, again, this is what advertising does. It promises you could be this fantastic person driving this great car with this beautiful person, male or female, at your side. The show is all about engaging you in that way, but also making it clear that that's a lie, that internally you don't have you may buy the suit, you may have, but you're not going to be Don Draper. To borrow a quip from Cary Grant, even Don Draper isn't Don Draper. We might all like to be, but no one actually is.
I was also going to say that one of the problems actually that the show has in terms of style is that it starts off in a period that we have forgotten sort of how good it looked, and we all became very attracted to it. Where it's going, of course, is the ugly 70s. And it's going there fairly well, right? And already, you know, this is, Banana Republic has been doing, obviously, the last couple of seasons, they've been doing, clothes based on Mad Men and tie-ins, but what are they going to do next year? It's not entirely clear because everything is going crass, everything is going loud, everything is going in a direction that is very much a kind of ugly, and I think that's going to be interesting for the show.
I totally love Abe, the new look for Peggy's boyfriend, very, very proto 70s. And I am waiting for Don's first fat tie. I feel like Megan will probably have to give it to him as a gift. But what I wanted to say before is about the advertising. That clip that you played for the Kodak carousel, Rob said that, you know, the show makes us want something. The show is about how advertising makes us want something, but that thing is a lie. And what I wanted to say is, yeah, exactly right. It's a lie, but at some level, it's also true. Because what we see in the Kodak carousel scene is that those images that Don pulls out of his train wreck of a life are really beautiful. He really loves Betty. He really loves his kids. He wants it to be as beautiful as an ad. And that's why the scene really moves us so much in the way that the ad only will for a second in the services of making us buy something. But the show itself is not an ad. And that's really important to bear in mind, because people who don't like it say it's just like an ad. It's like, no, not quite.
Well, one of the reasons I think that that comes up is because the show has an interesting relationship with the advertising world, because, of course, it does cover the advertising world from a certain period. And it's a very expensive show to make, so they also do have quite a bit of product placement. I mean, certainly it makes sense that they're showing real products, but they are also accepting money from some of these people. I mean, do you think that kind of complicates that broader point about advertising being hollow? And anyone who wants to jump on here may try to answer this question.
I think it just makes it better and better, right? I mean, I personally am not so interested in the product placements. I speed through the ads. It's interesting to me that brands like Dove want to create little Mad Men-esque set pieces for their commercials, but I still remember watching the show on DVD, and so for me, it's really a cultural text. That said, the fact that we all know that this is going on, the fact that we hear as much about, you know, Matthew Weiner arguing about money as we do things about what the show actually means on the level of a fictional narrative, it's certainly part of its texture, and we know that. You know, the show definitely points to things about the mechanics of making a show on purpose, because it doesn't want to present itself as being somehow pure art outside of the machine.
Well, we're talking about the new book, Mad Men, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s. Of course, Mad Men's new season debuted on AMC last night. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be taking your tweets and calls. If you have any thoughts on Mad Men, give us a call at 217-333-9455. You're listening to Focus on AM 580. You're listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Today we're talking about Mad Men. The sixth season premiere was last night, and we're here with the editors of a new book, Mad Men, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s. They are three professors from the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, Lauren Goodlad, Lilia Kaganovsky, and Robert Rushing. And we've been soliciting tweets and questions, and actually we just got one in from Lisa. Her question is, when Mad Men is over, will there be a next Mad Men-style show? For example, a show about the music business in the late 80s, early 90s. So much material. And I guess this question gets at why the early 60s like this and the mid-60s are such fertile terrain, and if another time period could be that fertile. And Lilia, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. I mean, I think that another time period could be that fertile. The question is getting it right. And getting, I mean, Mad Men itself, you know, Weiner pitched much earlier than AMC actually picked it up. He pitched it to HBO when The Sopranos was still on, and it didn't take off.
Yeah, he pitched it in 1999, right? Wasn't that the first time? And then the show didn't debut for like another 8 years?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And what was odd is that when it did debut, it seemed to really fit into the zeitgeist of the decade, right? It seemed to really be speaking to us in a certain way. I was going to go back initially to the opening credit sequence, and you had mentioned that at first we see Don falling out of the window, and then we see him reconstructed on the couch. In between those two scenes, the camera becomes our point of view. It looks down. We are the thing that's falling. And that seems to be part of the way in which this period of the 60s really tapped into the current moment.
Well, I'm thinking about TV shows that deal with periods in recent U.S. history, and it tends to be that the 70s is treated kind of nostalgically. The 80s is treated with nothing but derision. I don't know what a 90s period show would be like. I guess that's kind of the challenge, right? To make a show that actually is about something broader than just the surface aesthetic of, like, the 80s were lousy, for example.
We're probably too close to the 80s and 90s to write good historical television about them. You know, I think what really works so well about Mad Men, you know, one we've already mentioned, which is the fact that the early 60s, which we had forgotten, spoke so well to us in the 2000s. But the other is that
I was going to just add a little bit, which is that, for instance, for the 80s, we do have a show right now that is set in 1980. It's The Americans. I have been watching it without any joy for, you know, its entire season. And the things that they get wrong are precisely the period details and relevance are the two things that they seem to be missing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, The Americans is a show that I've tried to get into. I mean, I feel like a lot of it is just the quality of the show, right? Like, it's something to say, like, can we have another Mad Men-style show? Well, it's like saying, well, can we find another person on the level of, say, Matthew Weiner, who's the showrunner of Mad Men, who could take that point up?
Yeah, that's what I – thank you for letting me finish that. What we feel about that show is that, like, a whole generation of people remember living through it. But people who are the main cable TV watchers, they kind of remembered it and kind of didn't. And so it's just close enough to be something that can haunt us, and yet not so close that we're actually thinking about when we were doing Bell Bottoms or, Pat Benatar's Look, whatever it is that might scare us and make us shrink away from a show that really got into the details of the 70s and the 80s or the 90s.
And I would just say we talk actually in the introduction briefly, but we do sort of touch on the question of a few other historically set television shows and their attitude, the general smugness that actually does characterize most of our historical fiction. And there are plenty of shows that go back to the past to kind of mine them for their sense of adventure, shows that are set in the 1940s, for example. You've got the war, and you can talk about that. But I think that it would be – what we would really want to do is to go and find another era that we've kind of forgotten. The 1930s, for example, would be a really interesting time in American history, and one that I think unfortunately mm-hmm. speaks all too well to the present moment, with a Great Depression and a long period of time of unemployment and American difficulty.
Well, one show that's kind of trying to do that a little that I've never been able to get into is Boardwalk Empire, which is trying to look at Prohibition era, and it essentially has these aspirations to be a grand show like The Sopranos or Mad Men, but for my money, it doesn't quite reach that. I don't know.
Absolutely. I have the same reaction to it. It's visually glossy. It's extremely beautiful to look at. It has fantastic actors, and I think it has great writing. But for whatever reason, it does not grab the moment in the same kind of way. It doesn't speak to our historical moment in the same kind of way.
In a way, it's almost as though we could take away all the wrong lessons from Mad Men. And I mean, we've seen other shows that have come on and flamed out really quickly try to recreate the magic of Mad Men. Like, there was a show called Pan Am that was about stewardesses. And essentially, the only real relationship it had to Mad Men was that it was in the same period, it had the clothing, but it was just a terrible show on every level.
And actually, I mean, we watched at least the first one, possibly as many as two episodes of that one. But I would say that, you know, to go back to Smug, that show was smug. One of the moments was, you know, when all of the stewardesses are lined up and they're carrying their purses and they've got their scarves on and it's all, you know, very glam. And there's a character, male character, who looks at them and says, "These are the women of the future. Look how great they are." That's a smug attitude.
Oh,
that's
boy.
A 2012 attitude looking at 1962 instead of the other way around.
I think the other period show that's worth talking about here is Downton Abbey. And I know that I'm going to make a lot of your listeners really mad when I say that.
That airs on our PBS partner, by the
oh,
way.
So, oh, dear. It's a wonderful show.
Fire
and I think
away.
That everybody should watch it and donate to PBS. It's a beautiful show. It has a lot of the aestheticism. It has a lot of the really careful interest in period detail. But it's pure fantasy for people who want to imagine the aristocracy as having been everything that they should be, and want to imagine, you know, social relations just flowing harmoniously into one another, where everybody is happy being downstairs if that's where they are, and upstairs if that's what they were meant to be. And in that, you know, we have a show that at a popular level is probably working extremely well, but because it's selling a fantasy that actually is quite untrue.
And I would just add that it's absolutely true. It's a beautiful show, and it actually has some fantastic actors in it, some really great performances as well. But even setting aside the question of its perhaps objectionable ideology, there were moments in the first season, in particular of Downton Abbey, and in several of the early episodes that did manage to capture the strange, quiet slice-of-life approach that Mad Men often takes. Long scenes that are just filled with emotion, in which people aren't speaking. There's none of the later backstabbing and did he or didn't he and did so-and-so sleep with so-and-so, the kind of soap operatic elements that have also appeared in Mad Men. They haven't taken over the show is the good news. And I think that they do provide a kind of popular scaffolding that's really engaging for a lot of viewers. But there's the other stuff. There's the kind of big, quiet symbolism that's at work in Mad Men all the time. And Downton Abbey, I think, was particularly frustrating because it hasn't always managed to touch on that and to make that work for it.
As someone who loves Downton Abbey, I'll take those comments and
you can call that your guilty pleasure.
I will call that. Well, sometimes I call Mad Men my guilty pleasure. I mean, in a way, as much as Mad Men engages with all of these big ideas, if it did not have that kind of addictive narrative quality, we wouldn't be here talking about the show right now.
But why feel guilty about it? It's a good addiction.
It's an addiction that has some nutrients in it.
Right. Well, because it's making you reflective. I mean, I actually think that we need to think more about our past. We need to do more of the kind of thing that we're doing right now, which is to think about what matters to us, think about the relation between past and present, think about what disturbs us and why, think about what attracts us and why. So I think that in some ways, this is really an important thing for a culture to do. And when we lose that kind of reflectiveness, then we're just going, willy-nilly from one unmeaningful pleasure to the next. That's something I would feel more guilty about.
You're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube, and we're talking about Mad Men, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s with the editors of the book. If you have thoughts on Mad Men, if you love the show or have had trouble getting into it or just have any thoughts on what we've been talking about today, give us a call, 217-333-9455, or toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And, of course, you can reach us on social media, on Twitter, at Focus580. And on Facebook as well. And we've talked a bit, we've talked a bit about history. We've talked a bit about the aesthetics of the show. And the last third of your book engages with, I guess I could say sexual politics. Is that right? For lack of a better term, talking about gender roles. And I have a clip actually from the end of season 4 of the show, I believe. Mm-hmm. This is when Peggy and Joan are talking after it's just been announced that Don Draper is about to get married to his secretary. So here's that clip.
Can you believe it?
Happens all the time. They're all just between marriages, you know that. I'll probably make her a copywriter. He's not going to want to be married to his secretary.
Really? Is that what he meant?
Jesus. That's the way it works for some.
You know, I just saved this company. I signed the first new business since Lucky Strike left. But it's not as important as getting married.
Well, I was just made director of agency operations. A title, no money, of course. And if they poured champagne, it must have been while I was pushing the mail cart.
A pretty face comes along, and everything goes out the window.
Well, I learned a long time ago to not get all my satisfaction from this job.
That's from season 4 of Mad Men. That's Peggy and Joan, who are kind of secretly the heart of the agency. I mean, obviously, the show presents them as the heart of the agency, but to the outside world, they're not really seen that way. And I'm interested to talk a bit about kind of the sexual politics of the program and how it seems like we've been presented with a couple of female characters in the show. There's one that was introduced in season 4 and season 5, Megan, who's Don's new wife. And there are these sort of three main female characters who are all different images of how to get ahead as a woman in that period. And I wonder if anyone would like to talk about that particular issue. Lilia, if you'd like to take that.
Sure. I think that one of the things that's so brilliant about this show, even though the show is ostensibly about Don Draper, it really is about at least the three main female characters, although I think it goes even broader than that. But Peggy and Joan and Betty, and I'll include Betty in this because even though obviously the last two seasons she's been half off screen in a certain sense, she for the first three seasons she really represented also the heart of the show. The thing that I think the show managed to do, which if you look around television, it doesn't happen very often or in cinema either, is to create three incredibly interesting, very different, and none of them in a certain sense, to a certain degree, reductive versions of what it meant to be a woman, both then and also now, what it means to be able to, what are the different paths that are open to you? What are the different ways that you can manage career, looks, family, what, you know, whatever it happens to be, your own personal being. And I think that that's with Megan, you know, she's still a little bit up in the air, but I think we're beginning to like her more and more, particularly now that, you know, her new role on the soap opera is to be some sort of, you know, vicious person who pushes people down the stairs.
I've been really interested in the reactions from fans to the female characters on the show. They seem, on the whole, a lot less forgiving than the male characters who are on the show. Do you think that's true? I don't know. Does anyone seem to? Yeah, Robert, please.
I'll field that. I think that there is an element of truth to that, but I would concentrate specifically on the character of Betty here, who became fairly quickly, largely in the second and the third seasons, a character that audiences loved to hate. This was a real motivation for people to tune into the show. And certainly then the challenge, I think, for the showrunners and for the writers as well as for the actors was to find a way to make that character develop and move forward. And I think they've done so quite brilliantly, particularly with the fat suit that there's a little bit of that still going on. They really kind of ritually humiliated Betty until audiences could accept her again. And actually, I think last night's episode was a really great example of the continuing rehabilitation of Betty Draper, now Betty Francis.
Now we actually have a caller on the line, Ginger from Urbana. Ginger, you're on the air. Hello, is Ginger there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Hi, Ginger. Welcome to Focus.
Hi, thank you. I really enjoy the show. I went through where women were coming up into management things, which I didn't talk to the other men about that, but there's a lot of crazy things went on with women years ago, truthfully. I had to learn how to shake hands and take up more space, and that's the truth. But anyway, what I called about, there's a show on WILL that's set in the early 50s, mid-50s, and it's called Midwife, and it has really been an eye-opener with them. You know, the lack of, it was set in England, and it's delivering babies, and lack of birth control and the poor people, how they, you know, what was going on with them. And I just wanted to mention that when you were talking about other shows that are in other times. But I've really enjoyed watching it. I've never missed it. So.
Well, thank you very much, Ginger. Thanks for calling in. And yeah, Call the Midwife is the name of the show, and it's something I haven't gotten into yet.
I've been watching it, and thanks for bringing that up, Ginger, because I certainly prefer that to Downton Abbey, because I think it's telling us something about what England was like in the post-war period that is very important to remember. You know, I mean, it's in a way, it's making a case for the welfare state, because it's showing the impact that that was had when people had access to health care. What a great difference it made to not die in childbirth of completely curable things. So it works on a dramatic level too, though. I mean, it's well done. It's well acted. It is very interesting.
And I would just add that we have a fantastic essay in the book by Leslie Regan, who's also faculty here at the U of I, about reproductive technologies in Mad Men, how they're portrayed, and what's at stake in showing, you know, Betty Draper at the doctor's office as she learns that she's pregnant again, and what kinds of access women both had and did not have to reproductive technologies in the 1960s. Again, I'll go back to that clip you opened with and say it is a time machine. That's what the show wants to be. It's not a spaceship. It's not taking us towards the future. It's showing us how we got to where we are.
Well, thank you for an interesting program.
Thank you, Ginger. Thanks for calling in.
You know, I think that one of the things that was so interesting about last night's episode, and here I'm going back to what Lilia was saying earlier about Megan, is the reference to James Mason in the movie who walks into the sand at the end. And that is a reference to A Star is Born. That's the movie at the end of which James Mason commits suicide. And so what's going on is that Megan is the star that is born. And that's setting up Don as the person who is in decline. Is he finally losing his mojo? Is he going to be able to pull it out once again?
Boy, that's a spoiler for A Star is Born, by the way, if anyone has not seen that movie.
No, they mention it on the show. That's how they start. Well, I was going to say that, you know, I agree with Lauren, and then I'm going to disagree and say that, of course, that image of the ad for the Hawaiian Hotel of someone who's shed their clothes and walked into the ocean is, I believe, one of the closing episodes of season two of Don walking into the ocean in Los Angeles and then walking back out again, reconstitution, mm-hmm. rebirth. He's never he's fallen apart, but he's always come back together.
Yeah, I think it's really remarkable. And this is what, again, caught my interest about the show in the first place, the resonances with Antonioni's films of the 1960s. Suicide is seen as a strangely productive act in this show. And that's because it's a way of getting rid of your old identity and moving on to a new one. Don Draper has this cigarette lighter in last night's episode that he gets in the Korean War when he exchanges identities with an officer who's killed. And one of the things that happens on his Hawaiian vacation is that he accidentally exchanges that lighter with another one of a private that he meets in the bar in his Hawaiian hotel. Now, is this is yet another temptation for Don? Do I switch identities again? Do I become? It would be a demotion for him after all, going down from lieutenant to private. But this is something that endlessly fascinates him and always attracts him.
You're listening to WILL. This is Focus, and we're talking about Mad Men. The season premiere was last night, and there's a new book out called Mad Men, Mad World, Sex, Politics, Style, and the 1960s. It's interesting. I mean, kind of the talking about Don, it seems like all of that character is performance in a way. And this really talks to an essay in your book, actually, that's by you, Lilia, a little bit about how masculinity in the show is all just a performance, that Don's character is actually pretty sensitive. Like, we see these moments where we maybe get a glimpse of his true self as someone who maybe wants to be a little more bohemian or maybe wants to be different from who he's become, but that he needs to be kind of this rough, unforgiving masculine figure in the show.
That's right. And I think one, you know, I mean, then again, to go back to just briefly this moment of the clothes on the beach. Well, in a certain sense, there is no Don Draper except the clothes left on the beach. Right. I don't know what entity goes into the water. And that might be one of the things that he's concerned about. He is just the suits that constitute him in a certain sense, make up his identity. I think we're so used to thinking of women as performing. And we're not as used to, generally speaking, thinking of men as performing certain kinds of roles. And I think this show has been so good, in particular in the ways that once Don begins to resemble Roger, once Pete begins to resemble Don, we realize that these positions are both occupiable, interchangeable, and sheddable to some degree.
There's a great episode from last season in which the Drapers go to Pete Campbell's house out in the country. It's one of my favorite episodes. They go out to Pete Campbell's house in the country, and while they're for dinner along with some other people from the office, and while they're there, there's a problem with the sink, and it begins to spray water all over the kitchen. And Don rushes in and immediately pulls off his coat and his shirt, and one of the other women leans over and says, "Superman." And there's very much a sense that this is his performance as proper masculinity. But the show has been fantastic at giving us other moments, Don's drunken brawl with Duck Phillips, in which he just gets flattened immediately. He's no good in a fist fight at all. And we get to see that there is, in fact, some other side to Don, and that Superman aura that surrounds him is, in fact, just a performance.
But boy, can he fix that pipe, huh?
He really does.
We're going to have to wrap up in a moment, but I do want to talk a bit about what's coming up in this season. I know Matthew Weiner has probably sent you all the scripts in advance because he wrote a book about his show. What are you hoping to see, and what's kind of a thematic interest that you hope the show takes up? And we've got about 2 minutes to talk about that.
Okay, I never hope for anything at a serious level, but I did want for Megan to be in some ways more than Don could handle. And in that, my wish kind of came true. I also have long wanted Rachel to come back because I just absolutely loved her and wanted her to be the one that got away that somehow was going to come back. And I kind of feel last night that she did in a way, because in season two, we learn that Rachel marries Tilden Katz. And I think that Dr. Rosen is Tilden Katz reborn.
Oh, boy.
So I'm happy.
I think I have no, I think I only have fears and no desires. My fears are wide lapels and short ties, but I think they're coming anyways. I think that, you know, when I was thinking about the question about women on the show earlier, the one that hasn't been mentioned so far is Sally, because she hasn't yet quite, although did, you know, at the end of season five, enter into the category of woman. I think we're going to see more Sally. I think we would like to see more Sally, and I think she's really a terrific character.
And I'm looking forward to I was talking to Jason Croft, who runs the board on this show, and he was mentioning the inevitable ending when it's the 1980s and Don is sitting there drinking a tab and thinking back on his whole career and, you know, listening to new wave music or something. I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up there. I would like to say thank you very much to Lauren Goodlad, Lilia Kaganovsky, and Robert Rushing. And where can people find your book?
They can find our book on Amazon at the Duke University website, and they can also find it at the Illini Union Bookstore, where we will be doing an event for the book on, I believe it's April 26th, but can we email you that information so you can put it on your website?
Of course, we'll have that up on our website on the Focus page at wyll.illinois.edu.
And are there e-books available now for
Kindle
the book?
Is now available,
right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think Kindle and Nook maybe also,
perhaps.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for listening to Focus. Thank you for joining us today. We could talk about this forever.
Thank you so much.
Please visit us online on Twitter at Focus580, on Facebook, and on our website, will.illinois.edu. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Our technical direction was by Jason Croft. Please join us again tomorrow for Focus. Jim Meadows will be hosting the show, interviewing the man behind the documentary, The House I Live In, which is about America's longest war, the war on drugs. That's director, producer Eugene Jarecki on his show, The House I Live In. That's tomorrow on Focus on WYLL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll talk to you again next time on Focus.